I guess the worst case would be we do this and then somebody takes over who's as bad as the previous person, right? That could happen.
1 week into the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran, the rationale for entering the war, who will take over in Iran next, and how the U.S. gets out is unclear. This as the Pope advises restraint. We have expert analysis on the war in Iran from a Catholic perspective.
The Holy Father speaks every Wednesday in an audience and every Sunday during his Angelus to 1.6 billion people. What other entity has that power?
Insights from the Vatican, our on-the-record interview with U.S. Ambassador to the Holy See, Brian Birch.
We may look a little bit different, but I think our mannerisms are also sometimes very similar.
And Bishop Brothers. We share the faith journey of two siblings who have risen within the Catholic Church to lead their own vibrant dioceses. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
The United States military is undertaking a massive and ongoing operation to prevent this very wicked, radical dictatorship from threatening America and our core national security interests. The lives of courageous American heroes may be lost, and we may have casualties.
No stupid rules of engagement, no nation-building quagmire, no democracy-building exercise, no politically correct wars. We fight to win, and we don't waste time.
Where we stand right now, I think, is the very beginning of something that the president's administration did not anticipate, that Iran gets a vote and they get to fight back.
We have walked into a huge mess. You just can't go dropping a bunch of bombs and know where it's going to go, particularly in the Middle East.
Would you imagine what a world without wars would be like? A world without the terror of approaching explosions?
The United States and Israel go to war with Iran. And from the Pentagon to the White House, from military observers to Congress, and yes, from the Vatican, there are drastically different views about the wisdom of that decision. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadrow. We are now 1 week into a war in the Middle East Congress did not authorize, and polls show the American public does not support. In just a matter of days, massive U.S.-Israeli strikes against Iran have expanded into an all-out regional conflict and an international crisis. On Wednesday, a U.S. submarine torpedoed an Iranian warship near Sri Lanka, more than 2,000 miles from Tehran, stretching the battlefield to its farthest point since the war began. On that same day in Turkey, NATO defenses shot down an Iranian ballistic missile headed towards Turkish airspace. Iran has denied it was aiming for NATO member Turkey, but a strike against the country could activate NATO's mutual defense clause, drawing the treaty's 32 other member states into the war. Meanwhile, Israel has pushed further into Lebanon and has ordered hundreds of thousands of Lebanese citizens south of Beirut to evacuate, targeting Iran-backed Hezbollah. Iran has fired retaliatory strikes in at least 10 countries: Bahrain, Cyprus, Iraq, Israel, Jordan, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Syria, and the United Arab Emirates. Azerbaijan said Iranian drones had crossed into its border. The U.S. has closed its embassies in Saudi Arabia's capital of Riyadh and Kuwait City after they were both struck by Iranian drone attacks. No injuries have been reported. The U.S. also closed its embassy in Lebanon due to, quote, ongoing regional tensions. The spiraling war began last Saturday after months of indirect negotiations between the U.S. and Iran failed to produce any results. As those talks faltered, Washington slowly built its military presence in the Middle East. Then, in the early hours of Saturday morning, the U.S. launched what it called Operation Epic Fury alongside Israel. The two nations struck Iran's military sites and leadership, aiming to stamp out Iran's nuclear enrichment program. More than 1,200 people, many of them citizens, have been killed in Iran since Saturday. Israel's strikes killed the supreme leader of Iran, 86-year-old Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, a hardline cleric who led the Islamic Republic's oppressive regime for 36 years. Even with the supreme leader gone, retired Army General Wesley Clark says change is unlikely unless opposition groups are armed and able to pressure the existing leadership.
If you want the Iranian people to take back their government, they're not going to do it without arms. That's for sure. You've got a million Iranians under arms for this regime, both the regular army and the Revolutionary Guards and the Quds Force. So it's a little unrealistic to expect NATO bombing and then some unarmed protesters out in the street and suddenly the regime is going to surrender. I hope that'll happen, but I think it's unlikely.
Trump told Axios on Thursday he needs to be personally involved in selecting Iran's next leader, but noted earlier in the week that most of the people his administration had in mind have been killed. Iran has vowed to avenge Khamenei's killing, striking U.S. military bases across the region in retaliation. On Sunday night, shortly after the war began, six U.S. Army Reserve members were killed during a drone attack on a U.S. command center in Kuwait. The soldiers worked in logistics and kept troops supplied with food and equipment. The service members were assigned to the 103rd Sustainment Command out of Iowa and varied in careers. They have been identified as Sergeant Declan Cody from Iowa, Captain Cody Cork from Florida, Sergeant First Class Nicole Amor from Minnesota, Sergeant First Class Noah Teachins from Nebraska, Major Jeffrey O'Brien from Iowa, and Chief Warrant Officer 3, Robert Marzan from California. In Iran, civilian casualties include nearly 170 young Iranian girls whose elementary school was hit on the first day of the U.S.-Israeli bombardment. This week, thousands of mourners filled the street in the town of Minab for the girls' funerals, many wailing in grief. The school was next to a naval base belonging to Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard. When asked about the strike, Secretary Hegseth offered few details but said the strike was being investigated. With no clear U.S. exit strategy in the war in Iran, some lawmakers on Capitol Hill are attempting to bring a swift end to the conflict by trying to push through a war powers resolution demanding congressional approval before any further attacks are carried out. But in narrow, near party line votes, the House and Senate both rejected attempts to halt the attack. Lawmakers are confronting the reality of representing the nation in wartime and what that entails, including the loss of life, dollars spent, and strain to our global alliances. Democrats argue the president launched strikes without proper authorization and questioned whether Iran posed an imminent threat, justifying immediate military action. Republicans say the White House has the constitutional authority to protect the U.S. from Iranian threats.
We are not supposed to be at war without a vote of Congress. Members, including senators, like to duck and dodge and hide rather than be accountable. We all need to vote at this historic moment. Do we support this war or not? We're doing this to try to protect American troops from needlessly sacrificing their lives.
It would have been a very dangerous gambit to take the commander-in-chief's ability away to complete this mission. It would have been a very serious misstep by Congress, and I'm grateful that resolution failed.
In the meantime, the Pentagon is preparing to send Congress a supplemental funding request to pay for the war. The Center for Strategic and International Studies estimates the conflict is costing the U.S. nearly $1 billion a day. The hostilities in the Middle East are sparking extreme volatility in global energy markets and sending shockwaves through stock markets around the world. The New York Stock Exchange has experienced sharp sell-offs, and the S&P 500 fell into negative territory for the year because of the rising tensions. On Friday, crude oil prices neared a two-year high, and natural gas futures spiked. With shipping disrupted in the Strait of Hormuz, the narrow shipping lane between Iran and Oman, and a key route for tankers coming from the Persian Gulf. Though it is too early for oil shortages, tankers in the Gulf are not sailing towards delivery and are instead effectively anchored.
15% of the European Union's demand goes through the Strait of Hormuz. So if that is shut, then we have 15%, potentially 15% less oil that reaches us here. And globally, it's about 20%. So it is extremely important, not just for the European Union, but for countries like China, Asia in general, the United States.
Analysts say the price of oil is being pushed higher because markets are reacting to uncertainty rather than actual oil shortages right now. The concern is the expense of filling up the tank in the future could climb significantly higher.
For analysis on the current situation in Iran, we are joined now by Alex Vitanka, a native of Tehran. He is now based in the U.S. and is a senior fellow and founding director of the Iran program at the Middle East Institute, a nonpartisan think tank in Washington, D.C. Alex, thanks for joining us. How destabilizing is this moment for the Islamic Republic, now with the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei now killed?
Catherine, it's great to be with you. Look, there's no way of saying this other than to point out that the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei had been there since 1989. So just under 37 years in power. He's left some big shoes to fill, not necessarily in a good way. He is the man that I personally hold responsible for the state of affairs in many ways, but he's now gone. We don't really have a clear sense of the power dynamic in Tehran. There are different factions, there are different leanings in terms of where the country should go. But we don't know who's going to have the upper hand. And obviously, they have to make these very consequential political decisions at a time where the United States and Israel are actively, dropping bombs and missiles over their heads. So they don't have necessarily much time. They're under intense pressure, and they have to make some very big decisions going forward. Remains to be seen what they do next.
Well, leaning into that, can you explain the leadership vacuum in Iran right now and how Iran is currently being governed? The Iranian constitution did have a plan in place for this, right?
They did, and there will be probably at some point when the conditions allow for it, there will be probably announcement suggesting that a new supreme leader has been appointed. It's not the sort of central question, though, in many ways, because, you know, the supreme leadership is a position that really reflects the personality and the power that that person brings to the office, as opposed to the office giving you much power in itself. Mm-hmm. So it will take some time, even if there's a new supreme leader, for that person to see what they can do politically. And Ali Khamenei took a long time when he became supreme in 89. It took him a few years before he was comfortable in his new role to actually start sort of shaping the agenda. So, you know, right now there's an interim council. There are a number of leading figures inside the regime that are essentially running the everyday affairs, including the war effort. The supreme leadership symbolically is important. It will suggest continuity. The small base of people that still believe in this regime might want that kind of an appointment. But in terms of whether it's essential to have a supreme leader tomorrow or next week for them to continue doing what they're doing, I wouldn't say so.
Mm. Alex, I think a big question people are wondering is, how realistic is a regime change, in your opinion?
Look, I mean, we already have regime change. Ali Khamenei is dead. That is regime change. The question is the Islamic Republic going to be toppled entirely? I mean, the idea of theocracy, clerics ruling together with the Revolutionary Guards, that's a much bigger question. And I don't think we have very clear answer in terms of what the United States is after. President Trump's first week into this war has not given us clarity on that. He has mentioned all sorts of scenarios, one including dealing with someone coming from within the regime that he would be willing to work with, like he did in Venezuela. Other times he talks about, you know, arming ethnic groups to go in and by force take parts of Iranian territory, which suggests a very different trajectory going forward. So clarity on the part of the United States would help. Because I think a lot of folks inside an Iranian regime are looking for ways out. That's my estimation. And the other thing is, if there's clarity on the part of the United States, it would also help focus minds in the vast Iranian opposition, both outside of the country, but also those people inside who actually, in many ways, concluded long time ago that this regime's time is up and they're looking for a new future going forward. How that future is going to look like, obviously, yet to be debated. But I have no doubt that this regime, if it survives, will have to make some very tough decisions, including the one that is obviously most pressing, whether to talk to Donald Trump. He's asked for today unconditional surrender, or if they're going to sort of double down, if you will, and see if they can essentially tie the United States out and hope to survive that way.
And Alex, can you tell us what has the day-to-day looked like for Iranian citizens this week? The country has declared 40 days of national mourning.
Yeah, I mean, look, again, they've never been in this place before. Iran in its history has never been attacked on this scale before. So this is a moment where a lot of Iranians who, again, in my estimation, by and large, really did not like the Islamic Republic, still do not like the Islamic Republic, and yet now they have to sort of square not liking the political system that ruled over him since 1979 versus the very potentially dangerous future that lies ahead, including the idea of civil war. And I think that sort of a message of clarity from Washington, from the opposition, in terms of somebody having a roadmap for the day after, will help the Iranian people who right now, I can only imagine, and based what I've heard from inside of Iran, are extremely nervous because you know, the city of Tehran today experienced the heaviest bombardment in the last week of this war, and it could only get worse. So I only have empathy, and I hope this conflict would wrap up sooner rather than later.
Yeah, absolutely. Alex Vatanka, thank you so much for your expertise and your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Pope Leo XIV is expressing deep concern over the violent escalation of war in Iran. In an impassioned message during last Sunday's Angelus, he urged the faithful to pray for peace.
Stability and peace are not built with mutual threats, nor with weapons that sow destruction, pain, and death, but only through a reasonable, authentic, and responsible dialogue in the face of the possibility of a tragedy of enormous proportions. I make a heartfelt appeal to the parties involved to assume the moral responsibility to stop the spiral of violence before it becomes an irreparable abyss.
On Wednesday, the Holy Father shared that his prayer intention for the month of March is for disarmament and peace. In a video posted online, he is seen with an olive branch, a traditional gesture of goodwill and reconciliation. He recites his own original prayer for peace, where he says, "We are created for communion, not war, for fraternity, and not for destruction." Archbishop Paul Coakley, president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, issued his own strong call for restraint and peace. In his Sunday statement, he wrote, "My brother bishops and I unite our voice with our Holy Father and make the heartfelt appeal to all parties involved for diplomacy to regain its proper role. At this critical moment, I invite Catholics and all people of goodwill to continue our ardent prayers for peace in the Middle East, for the safety of our troops and the innocent, that leaders may seek dialogue over destruction and pursue the common good over the tragedy of war." As we approach 1 week since the U.S. and Israel launched their joint military operation against Iran, we're joined now by our panel of experts who provide both an international and Catholic lens to the Iran war. Dr. Marian Cusimano-Love is Associate Professor of International Relations and Chair of the Politics Department at the Catholic University of America. She serves as a consultant to the Holy See Mission at the United Nations and to the U.S. bishops. Alberto Fernandez is a former U.S. diplomat and an EWTN News contributor. He has held multiple senior public diplomatic positions, including in the Middle East. Thank you both for being here this week in particular. Since Saturday's strike in Iran, Catholics have been debating whether this moment meets the criteria for a, quote, just war. And for added context, the just war theory is a framework pioneered by Saints Augustine and Thomas Aquinas, which states war should be avoided at all costs. But if the correct conditions are present, a war can be justified. And I understand you two have some different perspectives here when it comes to whether these strikes meet that criteria. Marian, I want to start with you. Can the U.S.-Israeli strikes in Iran be justified from a Catholic lens?
The Catholic tradition is really clear on this, that you have to have multiple criteria met before you can go to something as drastic as war. And the first one is just cause. And what is not met in this case is that Catholic tradition does not allow preventive war. So that's what Cardinal Parolin was saying. Preventive war is not permissible as a just cause. Previous popes and the Catholic bishops have said this repeatedly in response to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And the reason is really sound. The Catholic Catechism says that it has to be imminent, grave, to qualify as self-defense, and threats that are more far off, more distant, or possible, but not imminent and grave and unavoidable, don't qualify as just cause.
Mm. Alberto, what is your response to that? Can the U.S.-Israeli strikes be justified?
Well, I think that they can be, and I don't see it as I'm not the expert that the professor is. it can be seen within the context, not of preventive war, but a war that's been going on for 47 years. This is a regime in Iran that has killed hundreds of Americans, that has attacked embassies, that has kidnapped and tortured Americans. There's an Iranian agent on trial right now in the United States for plotting to assassinate senior politicians in the United States. He was arrested by the Biden administration. So from 1979 and the attack of the American embassy, the killing of Americans in Beirut, in Iraq, to right now, this is a regime which is actually sees itself as waging war against the great Satan, the center of global arrogance worldwide.
Wow. While Pope Leo did not answer media questions outside his Castel Gandolfo residence this week, he did make a point to call for peace. Let's take a listen.
Let's pray for less hatred and for more peace and work for authentic dialogue. God bless you all.
Marianne, Pope Leo did comment on Iran specifically during his Sunday Angelus address, urging for diplomacy. How do you interpret the statements our Holy Father has been making since this war was escalated?
The church is always calling for movements towards dialogue, towards engagement, because war is often self-defeating. It often causes worse harms than the intention that it is attaching itself to. So, for example, one of the criteria, one of the rationales given for the U.S. Attacks has been to stop Iran's terrorist activities. But terrorism is worse in war zones, and the deaths from terrorism are worse in war zones. So if you expand the war, you actually expand terrorism. Mm-hmm. You don't stop it or undermine it. Mm-hmm. So the data is not good on showing that even if you wanted to stop terrorism, as Alfredo was saying, or if you had this good intention that you thought this could help that, it often doesn't turn out that way. And the same is true about thinking that it's better to act now than later. The data doesn't show that works out very well. So in this sense, Catholic tradition is really wonderful because we don't think faith and reason are opposed. We think our faith and science and data work together. And in this case, the more data, the more information we have about wars, about terrorism, about wars to end terrorism, the more we found empirical evidence to support just what the Holy See and the bishops mm-hmm. are saying.
Alberto, as we look at the latest developments in Iran, can you explain to us what is the ideological motivation of the regime? What do we need to know about that reality there?
Well, I would say there are two elements in the regime. First of all, it is a revolutionary regime. It is deeply ideological, and it has an ideological worldview influenced, by the way, by Marxism, but basically a certain branch of Shia Islam. You know, the creation of the Wilayat al-Faqih way of governing, and an apocalyptic view of the world, which sees that Iran's role is to bring about, it sounds crazy, but bring about at some point the end of the world, the coming of al-Mahdi al-Muntadhar, the awaited Mahdi that's supposed to come. So that's one element, a kind of deeply ideologically, religiously influenced worldview. The other one is enmity against the United States. It isn't Israel that's the great Satan. It's America. It isn't death to Israel that they say. They add that on sometimes. It's death to America. That is a basic element of the Iranian worldview. And I was struck a little bit by the reference to terrorism. This is a regime that just killed 20 to 30,000 Iranians a month ago. And we're talking about the fear that a terrorism might occur. This is a regime drenched with blood on its hands. An unjust regime, as St. Augustine would have called it, who said that if unjust regimes exist, they're no worse than pirates or bandits or thieves.
We absolutely need to be praying for peace. And Marianne, you work towards peace building across the globe. Peace is ultimately the church's hope here. But realistically, what does that even look like? What can that look like? What do you think needs to happen next for lasting peace to even be realistic in the region?
Yeah, destruction is easy. Building peace is hard. It takes a long time. And it takes the imagination to imagine a world that even includes our adversaries. You know, I agree with our brother that This is obviously a regime that has committed terrible human rights abuses and atrocities. No one is doubting that. There are many regimes like that around the world. But the question is whether war makes that worse or makes that better. In my research and work with Christian communities in Iraq, they have no love for these dictators in their region. But they say that often this seemingly easy activity of removing a dictator from power creates a situation that's far, far worse. You know, many of the Iraqi Christians that had to flee ISIS in the Nineveh Plains that I talked to said, you know, Saddam Hussein was terrible, but when he was removed from power, then we had 1,000 Saddam Husseins. Mm. So it's easy to imagine that there'd be a simple, silver bullet here, that by taking out these terrible leaders, that you would automatically have a better outcome. But what often happens is you may get a worse outcome than what your intention was and that you hoped to attain by the use of force. Mm. So that's the challenge there.
Absolutely. You mentioned Iraqi Christians. Well, earlier this week, the Chaldean Catholic Archbishop of Erbil, Iraq, Archbishop Bashar Warda, told EWTN News that one of his greatest concerns as this war expands is that it will convince Christians in Erbil it's not worth staying. Here's what he had to say.
Erbil has been targeted a few times so far, and we know the largest Christian gatherings in Iraqi Christian gatherings is in Erbil, and this might be also another reason for the Christians to say there's no future.
And the day after that interview, a missile hit a special site for Christians in Erbil, which happens to be very close to our own EWTN News Asi Mena office. Alberto, can you speak to how concerning that is and your thoughts on how this war will be impacting Christians in the Middle East?
Well, first of all, I would say three things. Number one, of course, Iran itself is a great persecutor of Christians within Iran. People are jailed for having a Persian language Bible in Iran, and Christians are sentenced to long jail sentences. But in the two places most impacted by the war and the Christians are Iraq and Lebanon. In Iraq, of course, we had the act that you described, mm-hmm. which was claimed by one of the Shia militias controlled by Iran that mm-hmm. claimed it and said that they were attacking a Zionist American site, and they posted a mm-hmm. picture of it. At the same time, in Lebanon, of course, Lebanese are very worried about the war, Lebanese Christians, but they're also hopeful that maybe that they will be liberated from the tyranny of Hezbollah, Iran's agent in Lebanon that has oppressed them and murdered them for decades now.
Miriam, this week, many people have been drawing comparisons between the U.S.-Israeli strikes in Iran with the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq. And obviously, there are some fundamental differences between the regions and those military interventions. But we do know that the U.S. bishops vocally oppose President George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq. Do you expect the U.S. bishops today have parallel concerns, especially based on Archbishop Coakley's call for peace this week?
Yes, the concerns are very similar. The concerns are that war, once unleashed, will destabilize the region, cause more harm than good, cause more harm than intended, and have unintended consequences, particularly for the most vulnerable in that region. That was, the bishops absolutely called it in the letter that they wrote to President Bush, urging him not to invade. Everything that they were concerned about came to pass. And all of those same concerns are present in this situation. Mm. It's easy to overestimate that you could have a quick, easy victory and that all would be better afterwards. But the bishops have long experience in these areas. The church has long experience in these areas. And they are speaking from that painful voice of the church in the region, that often the outcome can be far worse than is intended by U.S. policymakers.
Mm. Alberto, finally, as a former U.S. diplomat, what insight or advice would you want to share with the Trump administration during this uncertain time in the Middle East right now?
Well, it's basically they're committed to a very difficult situation, and they have to see it through. My sense is that they've learned the lessons of Iraq. Certainly, Trump was a critic of the war in Iraq. and that they realize that an open-ended conflict, a long conflict, is something that certainly nobody in the United States wants. I want victory. I want American victory. I'm an American, and I want the Americans to win the war. But I also don't want a long war, and I don't want suffering to happen. I think that there is a possibility for a better future for Iran, but at the end of the day, it's going to have to be the Iranian people that are going to have to find that way, easy or difficult, to arrive to that end.
Well, our prayers certainly continue. Thank you both for your expertise, Dr. Marian Cusimano-Lev, Alberto Fernandez. Thank you.
Thank you.
The sudden start of the war caught global travelers off guard, stranding hundreds of thousands of people when more than 20,000 flights were canceled in and out of the Middle East. The busiest airport in the world, Dubai International Airport, was forced to close as missiles flew through its airspace. The long-haul hub connects Europe, Asia, and Africa. Air traffic there remains snarled a week later.
Within the Middle East, an eight-hour flying distance covers two-thirds of the world population. So it is a strategic corridor in terms of being able to move west to east. 20 to 30% of the world's travel and trade goes through that corridor.
It was a scene of chaos 1 week ago when the airport first closed down. Passengers in long lines found out they would be stuck in Doha for days. Various governments around the world scrambled to arrange charter flights or alternate land routes to evacuate their citizens out of countries affected by missile attacks. The U.S. State Department told Americans to leave those countries immediately, but with its staff cut nearly 50% last year by DOGE, did not have the manpower to provide the services that many other countries did. As a trickle of flights resumed, passengers finally arriving home expressed their frustration.
Having the State Department or whoever tell us, you need to get out immediately, well, but there's no help. So you're on your own to get your own travel plans. And that was the most stressful thing.
The World Travel and Tourism Council estimates more than 1 million people were swept up in the ripple effects of what it called an aviation, travel, and safety crisis. And it says this war and other conflicts around the world are threatening this year's $12 trillion global tourism industry. The wide-reaching effects of war, even for those thousands of miles away. We have more news for you on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. Stay right there.
This is what the church brings to the world, and this is a pope, I think, who really wants to heal some of the things that I think our modern world is struggling with.
Our on-the-record interview with the U.S. Ambassador to the Holy See. Ryan Birch shares his insights half a year into his job as America's top diplomat at the Vatican.
When we were growing up, I think it was Greg who we always thought would be the priest in the family.
And later, two brothers, two bishops. We trace the faith formation that led these two men to serve God.
One of the greatest honors any American can receive is to be named an ambassador representing the United States overseas. The Trump administration's choice to serve as ambassador to the Holy See is Brian Birch, the co-founder and president of Catholic Vote, a political advocacy group focused on Catholic issues. He has now been on the job nearly 6 months and sat down with EWTN News in Depth correspondent Colin Flynn to share his insights so far on his role. Here is Ambassador Brian Birch on the record.
I was talking to someone the other day, and they were American, and they said to me, Colm, I think the Vatican is anti-America. Look at the fact that we have our first American Pope, but President Trump and the Pope have not met yet. I don't think, to the best of my knowledge, they've even spoken on the phone. The Vatican, before it confirmed what countries the Pope would be visiting, it confirmed a country it would not be visiting this year, the United States. In his first interview, when he was asked about his brother's political views, his brother has said that he's a MAGA supporter, went to the White House. The Pope said, well, we would have differing political views there. Also, the Vatican said they didn't want to join President Trump's peace board. When you look at all of that together, is it a fair assessment that the Vatican might be anti-America?
No, it's not at all. I think, the common things that the Vatican and the Holy See in the United States share go much beyond kind of the political framing that I think a lot of people want to interpret. I will say, from the first kind of days that I began working, I remember a comment one of the highest ranking cardinals said to me. He said, you know, when we deal with a lot of these difficult issues, often we don't always know what the answers are. And one of the things we often come back to is we need to talk to the United States. And it's not because we are the, you know, the have the perfect answer to every question, but it's because we share this kind of Western civilizational idea that we inherited, again, as the Secretary recently said, from Europe, but also that the Holy See and the United States share this common bond about truth and justice and human dignity and fundamental freedom, understanding of freedom. These are kind of perennial things that transcend the politics. And I know it's easy to kind of politicize, well, they didn't join the Board of Peace, and there's reasons for that, or he may have made a comment about the United States. I think this Pope in particular, is going to be very careful to not come across as kind of an American who's meddling in politics. And in fact, he said that directly to me when I met him.
Really? Yeah, is that going to be one of the great challenges for Pope Leo, in that no matter what he says on any issue, it will always be seen through the prism of what the U.S. administration is doing at that current time in that area?
This Pope, he said to me when I first met him, you know, I don't want to be seen as kind of an American who's trying to, meddle in the domestic political fights in the United States. He said, I'm not an American Pope. I'm a Pope from America for the world.
Is there a reason, Ambassador, that he and President Trump have not met yet or spoken on the phone?
No, I think he's going to meet the president at some point. He was considering, I think, coming this year. The United Nations has invited him to speak. He had considered a visit and then decided to push it off probably till next year is what we anticipate.
So far, I think, is it once you've met him or how many occasions?
You know, I spent about 45 minutes with him when I presented my credentials. That was the longest meeting.
Did any controversial issues come up? For example, the U.S. and immigration?
A bit. We weren't shy about saying we knew some of these issues would be potential sources of conflict, and it wasn't. It was mostly us getting to know each other and how we would try to talk through some of this. There wasn't, you know, the first meeting is one of courtesy and cordial and graciousness, so it wasn't hostile in any way.
That's something that many Catholics have been looking at as well, how to understand, you know, in their mind, of course, the United States and the administration and their right to protect the borders and their country and deport people who are there illegally in a humane way, as Pope Leo has called for, with humanity and dignity. But then on the other hand, like when they see what had happened in Minnesota with that terrible tragedy, mm-hmm. and they wonder, is the administration going too far? They're listening to the Pope, who seems to share the same concern. As a Catholic yourself, how do you marry the two? Or when you see what is happening with ICE, how does it make you feel?
Well, certainly seeing the events in Minnesota from afar over here, it was terrible. The larger question of immigration is something that will constantly be a source of debate and conversation between the U.S. and the Holy See. I think the thing that frustrated me is there was a lot of accusations that somehow this is born out of some, you know, xenophobia or hate, when I know this administration, this president, is deeply committed to protecting the safety and security of our country. This was what he was elected on. I think this is what people expected him to do. We lived for, you know, 4 years of chaos where our border was overrun, where migrants were exploited, where people were coming into our country unaccounted for, where children were lost throughout our country, and the president said enough. And he had the courage to do something very difficult. And I think people sometimes underestimate the difficulty of unwinding the chaos that had occurred. Now, as a Catholic, of course, we believe that all humans have dignity. They deserve respect, and certainly in the administration of the law, including in the deportation process, that we have to do so in a way that respects that dignity. And I think that's where the debate is occurring. And the fact that there were terrible things that happened, we should all have, you know, regret and remorse and recognize this is not how it's supposed to work. Law enforcement should be able to do its job without being impeded, without there being violence, and that the way that we went about this should be done in a way that would respect the dignity of those that have broken our law and that need to return home.
Let me ask you about another huge story in which now we know the Vatican was involved. I'm talking about Venezuela and the removal of Nicolas Maduro. The Washington Post reporting that the Vatican, working with the United States and other countries possibly, were trying to organize some sort of escape passage from Maduro into another country.
Well, right. The Washington Post did report a story that on Christmas Eve, I was here with my family and got a call and ended up in the Vatican in a meeting where we were discussing this.
Who calls you on Christmas Eve from the Vatican?
My staff, who gets a call from the staff of the Vatican, says Cardinal Parolin would like to see you. And we did discuss this, and I was at the Apostolic Palace talking about this question, and it's certainly our country at the time was looking at trying to resolve the problem of a narco-terrorist who had cheated in his election, who had basically was illegally controlling his country. And the Secretary Rubio and the State Department was working to try to find a peaceful way for Maduro to leave. The Vatican conversations that I had were just one piece of a much larger effort on the part of the United States government to try to find a way to not have to use the military to solve this. Unfortunately, I think...
What was it, Ambassador? What was Plan B? I know it was reported possibly go to Russia.
Yeah, you know, I'm not going to get into a lot of the details. I think the Vatican, being the Vatican, wanted to try to find a peaceful resolution to this. And there was lots of options, as I understand it, that were presented to Maduro. Secretary Rubio and others were negotiating with different countries to try to find a way to peacefully resolve this. And regrettably, Maduro did not accept any of the offers. He was resistant and thus forced the hand of the U.S. government to go in and enforce the law and to remove this narco-terrorist and put him into the justice system where he will soon have his day in court.
And from politics to personal, Ambassador Birch also speaks to Colum about his own Catholic faith, what it means for him both professionally and personally to be appointed the ambassador to the Holy See and to work within the highest levels of the Vatican. To watch Colum Flynn's entire on-the-record interview with Ambassador Brian Birch, go to EWTNnews.com/watch. A big shakeup at the White House. President Trump fires Kristi Noem as the head of the Department of Homeland Security. That and other news headlines are next in the Week in Review.
President,
no, you're
going to
do this?
Yes.
He did?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
And one thing, Senator, I think would be helpful to know is how effective that communications has been.
Effective in your name recognition. To me, it puts the president in a terribly awkward spot.
The last straw, a weak performance amid a series of tough questions this week on Capitol Hill, led to President Trump firing Kristi Noem as Secretary of Homeland Security. That story tops our news headlines in the Week in Review. The president reportedly angry that Noem told senators he approved she could spend $220 million taxpayer dollars for a big TV ad campaign that featured her in border security commercials. During 2 days of withering questioning this week in the Senate and House Judiciary Committees, members also asked her about her lease of a luxury jet for executive travel she also claimed would be used for deportations. The awarding of a no-bid $140 million contract to a firm run by Noem's friends that did not even exist just 8 days before it received the contract. The slow walking of FEMA relief funds more than a year after several natural disasters, like in areas of North Carolina devastated by Hurricane Helene, and very pointedly, ICE deportation tactics and her characterization of shooting victims Alex Preddy and Renee Good without evidence as involved in domestic terrorism. The criticism came from both Republicans and Democrats.
And what we've seen is a disaster under your leadership, Ms. Noem, a disaster. What we've seen is innocent people getting detained that turn out are American citizens. I could talk about the culture that's been created here.
Madam Secretary, you've provided no evidence to back up your defamatory lie against either of these American citizens. There have been 3 homicides in Minneapolis in 2026. Your agents committed 2 of them. Rather than work with state and local authorities to solve these homicides, you barred Minnesota's investigators from the crime scenes.
After what many observers called her disastrous Capitol Hill appearance, President Trump fired Noem on Thursday, announcing he is nominating Republican Senator Mark Wayne Mullen of Oklahoma to replace her as Secretary of Homeland Security, effective at the end of this month. The Oklahoma governor is required to appoint another Republican to replace Mullen in the Senate. That person will hold the seat until the November midterm election. The Noem testimony this week came as a partial government shutdown continues for the Department of Homeland Security. ICE, Customs and Border Control, FEMA, TSA, and the Coast Guard are among the agencies not being funded right now as part of a tug of war on Capitol Hill over ICE. Democrats say they will only agree to fund the department if guardrails are placed on ICE and Customs and Border Control officers after the deadly shootings in Minneapolis. Those proposed guardrails include a ban on face masks, mandatory name identification and body cameras, de-escalation training, and judicial warrants for arrests on private property. There might be another contentious meeting with Congress for Attorney General Pam Bondi as the Trump Justice Department continues to come under scrutiny for its apparent mishandling of the Jeffrey Epstein files.
I believe you just lied under oath. There is ample evidence in the Epstein files.
Don't you ever accuse me of a crime.
Just 3 weeks ago, she gave combative testimony before the House Judiciary Committee as she defended the Justice Department's piecemeal and highly redacted release of the Epstein files. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have expressed frustration at the department's lack of transparency in the Epstein case. With broad bipartisan support this week, the House Oversight Committee voted to subpoena Bondi, which will force her to testify under oath in a closed-door taped deposition. Both Democrats and Republicans are accusing her of improperly withholding Epstein files in violation of the law. The New York City Police Department officially has a new chief chaplain. Cardinal Timothy Dolan, who just retired from his role as the Archbishop of New York, will lead the NYPD Chaplains Unit alongside the Reverend A.R. Bernard, founder of the Christian Cultural Center.
Congratulations.
Dolan and Bernard were sworn in on Wednesday during a ceremony at NYPD headquarters. The two Christian leaders will oversee an interfaith team of 10 clergy members who provide spiritual support to more than 33,000 officers and 15,000 civilian workers in the force. As the Archbishop of New York for nearly 17 years, Dolan has long had a relationship with the NYPD and sees this new role as a way to continue his priestly and pastoral service to the city. This week, another American Catholic is being recognized for her profound leadership and contributions to the church. The Given Institute announced it will award Mother Agnes Mary Donovan with the Thea Award for her gift of spiritual motherhood and her leadership of the Sisters of Life for nearly 30 years. She recently reflected on her life and vocation in an interview with our Colin Flynn.
We live in an age when most people don't get up in the morning and feel that their life matters deeply. Too many. They question the meaning and the purpose of their lives, you know? And our purpose as Sisters of Life is to answer that very ache in the heart of man, which is to say that you are of infinite value.
The Sisters of Life is a religious order dedicated to serving pregnant mothers in need and accompanying women who have undergone abortions. Mother Agnes left a successful career in psychology to join what was then the newly founded community in 1991, becoming one of its 8 founding sisters. She led the order as its first superior general for nearly 30 years, helping the Sisters of Life expand across the country and to encounter tens of thousands of women. There is much more to Colin's conversation with Mother Agnes, including her vocation story and her reflections on her order's mission. You can watch the full interview at EWTNnews.com/watch. Lou Holtz, the legendary Notre Dame football coach, sports commentator, and devout Catholic, died this week. He was 89. Known for reviving football programs, Holtz led 6 major colleges to bowl games, but he is best known for reviving the Fighting Irish and leading them to an undefeated national championship in 1988. The unassuming head coach never strayed from his commitment to excellence and expected the best from his players. A lifelong Catholic, Holtz once said he prayed to God to be a great athlete, only to have been made a coach instead, remarking that God answers our prayers, but not always in the way we expect. Eternal rest grant unto him, O Lord. We'll be right back in a moment.
The fact that my brother said yes to God, I think gave me the courage to do so as well.
Brothers in the church and brothers by blood, we introduce you to the Bishop's Parks,
among the very few pairs of brothers who have ever served as bishops in the United States. Their vocation story when we return.
There are more than 400 active and retired Catholic bishops in the United States, and those brother bishops share a special and unique bond with one another, but perhaps no more than one pair of bishops in particular, brother bishops who are biological brothers. Bishop Gregory Parks of St. Petersburg, Florida, and Bishop Stephen Parks of Savannah, Georgia, are the 11th pair of brother bishops in the history of the Catholic Church in the United States. Both are quite busy these days tending to their respective dioceses, but their work does bring them together at different times, including at the most recent U.S. Bishops General Assembly in Baltimore. That's where I got to sit down with them to hear their faith journey in depth. Bishop Parks, thank you for joining me.
Pleasure to be with you today, yes. Catherine.
Well, it's my joy. You both have a really unique story, the 11th pair of brother bishops in the history of the U.S. Catholic Church. You're not just brother bishops, you're brother bishops. So I'd love to just lean into that unique family dynamic and unique vocation story. First off, who's the older brother? Who's the younger brother?
So I'm 14 months older than my brother Stephen to the day. My birthday is April 2nd, his is June 2nd. So we're 14 months apart. So I guess I'm the older brother by age, but he's my older brother in the priesthood because he entered seminary a year before I did and was ordained a priest a year earlier.
A lot of times people might ask a priest, well, when did you know that you had a vocation to the priesthood? But I'd like to ask you, when did you know your brother might have a vocation? And, you know, were you two pious young brothers who never fought? What was that dynamic like?
I think, first of all, when we were growing up, I think it was Greg who we always thought would be the priest in the family. There's three boys in our family. And I think, Greg, you just had the disposition that was certainly one that we thought he would be called to be a priest. And thank goodness you said yes. What a huge blessing. So that was when we were younger. When I was growing up, I wanted to be a physician. And I realize now at this point in life that God wanted me to be a doctor, and I am a doctor of souls, so in a different kind of way.
Bishop Gregory, when did you suspect your brother might have a calling?
Really not until after college. We both spent some years working in business after we graduated from college. And during that time, Stephen kind of went from one thing to another, which is kind of a sign that you're searching. And then eventually he shared that he was discerning a vocation to priesthood. And so I guess at that point we knew, but it wasn't really evident until you were probably in your mid-20s, I would say.
Definitely. It was after college was when I really started seriously discerning. And I remembered it was a great joy when we found out you came home at Thanksgiving to visit and then said that you were going to be hoping to enter the seminary the next fall.
I mean, seeing your brother enter seminary, did that further prompt you?
I think a little bit. He had a very good experience his first year. And I think it did give me the courage to finally say yes to God's call, something I had been thinking about for a number of years. But certainly the fact that my brother said yes to God, I think gave me the courage to do so as well.
That's beautiful. And now that you both are busy bishops leading your respective dioceses, how often do you get to communicate with one another and see each other?
Well, I like to say, it's a question I get asked a lot. Do you get to see your brother very much? Actually, I think we get to see each other more now that we're both bishops, mm-hmm. because we come to meetings a couple times a year at the national level. We're on the board of trustees at our seminary, so we meet twice a year there. We go on retreat with other bishops once a year, and then in any other occasions that we might get together. And we prefer to text each other rather than spend long conversations on the phone. I think that's our preferred way of communicating.
And that's probably typical for a lot of adult siblings. I think we do pretty well, which is good.
You both are quite busy, too, on top of that. Do you feel like you can confide with one another and help each other out with maybe different issues you're thinking through in your respective leadership positions?
Yeah, I would say, Catherine, we've always been that way, even when we were priests in Orlando and named pastors of brand new parishes, so starting a parish from the ground up. We would meet on a weekly basis and talk about the challenges we were facing. And I would ask my brother, you know, how are you doing this? Or what did you do to get this started? So we often would help each other in that way. And when Stephen became a bishop, I didn't want to give him a lot of information. But I think I told him that I'm always here, always available if he had any questions.
I think being the younger brother, you want to kind of make sure you figure things out as best you can. But I'm very grateful to be able to have the wisdom and more experience, especially in the episcopacy. So it's been a real blessing to be able to speak with you. And always we make time when we are together for some family time. I think that that's very important.
Outside of work and just mm-hmm. purely as brothers.
Sure.
Do you tend to agree on most everything when it comes to matters of the church, or what's that dynamic like?
I would say for the most part, we're on the same page. Might be some small things or way of doing things that we differ, but stylistically, but in terms of faith and the beliefs and teachings of the church, I think we're on the same page.
We may look a little bit different, but I think our mannerisms are also sometimes very similar.
I can see that as well. And do you think your governing styles are similar too?
I do. I believe as priests and pastors, we were both very pastoral in our approach to ministry. I know I've tried to bring that to my time now as a bishop, my leadership, and I think my brother has done the same.
I also think that our father... I often look to maybe his example of fatherhood and think of how he dealt with situations, whether it be at work or in the home. And I think that was a good example and an inspirational as well.
I think I can envision maybe some of our viewers watching this dynamic and thinking, well, what did their parents do? To maybe it was to instill the certain charisms you kind of need to have as bishop, you know, whether that's governance, administrative skills and what have you. Was there anything in that nature that you look back and think, yeah, that was a skill set instilled in us by our parents?
I think my answer would be that our parents, when we were young as kids, always gave us a very good example of what it means to serve God and to serve his people. As a family, we were always very involved in ministry at our parish. The boys were altar servers. We were involved in youth ministry. My parents were served on the parish council, and eventually my mom worked for our parish. So I think it's just part of how things were when we were growing up, and they passed that example of service on to us.
And they loved the church. Yeah. And that was very evident in our home. You know, the church was a second home for us. We could walk to the church, and it was a place where we always felt very comfortable. And I think that certainly allowed us to freely discern and to be encouraged with a vocation.
Oh, I would agree. We always had priests who were pretty close friends of our family that would come over for dinner and spend time with us, holidays and so forth. So it was something we were very comfortable with, and our parents certainly encouraged us to consider vocations to the priesthood.
And I understand, if I'm correct, that both of your parents have since passed away. Yeah. But what would they think if they were to see their two sons leading as bishops together?
I think they'd be very, very pleased, probably surprised, I'm not sure, but certainly very pleased. I think that they would enjoy visiting Savannah and St. Petersburg, and you know, their presence is with us in a very special way. In their absence, they have a whole new presence.
Yeah, I like to think they're watching over us from heaven and certainly helping us, you know, with their prayers to be the men, to be the bishops that God has called us to be.
Well, Bishop Parks and Bishop Parks, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Kath.
Thank you, Catherine.
Siblings encouraging each other along their vocation journey. It's great to see. And that's this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadrow. Thank you for joining us. We hope to see you again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. Until then, God bless.